For the 2022 Hauser Lecture at MSU, Professor Kyle White presented a talk entitled Indigenous Climate Justice, Transforming Law, Energy, and Science. Professor White was introduced by Kristen Intiman, Professor of Philosophy in the Department of History and Philosophy, and Director of the Center for Science, Technology, Ethics, and Society.
Dr. Kyle White is currently the George Willis Pack Professor at the School of Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan, where he's also an affiliate professor in both philosophy and Native American studies. He's an enrolled member of the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. He has published countless articles, and literally, I started counting and then, there was just too many. So literally countless articles on environmental justice, climate policy, indigenous peoples, the ethics of cooperative relationships between indigenous peoples and science organizations, and the problems of indigenous justice in public and academic discussions of food sovereignty, environmental justice, and the Anthropocene. His research and educational projects have been supported by the National Science Foundation for over a decade, and he's earned multiple awards and recognitions for both his research and his outreach and engagement efforts in both the US and Canada. Perhaps even more impressively to those of us in the world of academia, he has successfully translated his academic scholarship into a real-world force for change through activism, community organizing, the mentoring of Indigenous students and researchers, and policymaking. Kyle currently serves on the White House Environmental Justice Advisory Council and has served as an author for the U.S. Global Change Research Program, including the National Climate Assessment and for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the Working Group 2, the IPCC Working Group 2 report. He's also involved with a number of organizations that advance Indigenous research and education methodologies. And given all of that that he's doing, we are really particularly grateful for the time he's taken to come here to be with us tonight. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Kyle White for his talk, Indigenous Climate Justice, Transforming Law, Energy, and Science.
Hey, it's fantastic to be here with you all, and good to have a chance to share, to discuss. And I've for a long, long time been a big, big fan of Native Studies at Montana State. And it was great, actually, to be doing a master class earlier today in a classroom called the Walter Fleming classroom. Yeah, I was actually worried as a Algonquin person myself from that part of the country if I get any respect here. But then I Professor Fleming is a Kickapoo from Kansas, isn't that right? So I felt better. Felt better about the respect. That great to be here with folks I really consider to be luminaries like Marcia Small and many other colleagues that I encountered. So. And this is just a doggone beautiful place. I wish I could offer the same scenery in Michigan, but we'll have to find some other thing of at the same level of enjoyment and beauty. So, all right. Well, I wanted to talk a bit about some of the recent work that's happening on this key topic of climate change and Indigenous people, and especially give you all some information about resources and information that's out there to give you more of the specific story. Because in the work I do, you know, I really want to be working with folks, Native folks, that are at the forefront of engaging with, dealing with climate change, coming up with creative Indigenous-led solutions. And so I want to share a little bit about that world, the different philosophies involved, the practices involved, in the time that I have here with everybody. And so anyways, in terms of the work I do, you know, first and foremost, I work at the grassroots seeking to make change to establish environmental justice. And so I'm part of a number of amazing projects that we do just in Michigan. And for me as a Potawatomi person, even though the tribe I'm enrolled in is in Oklahoma, Michigan's actually our homeland. That's where our ancestors come from. And so conserving those homelands, protecting the landscape, the environment, is critical. And it's not just Native people. We've got many allies, many Black and Brown communities. And we work together. We build coalition. We find the different similarities and overlaps with our experiences and ways to work together. And so taking action, power building for the sake of protecting the environment is at the core of the work that I do. For a long, long time, I've invested a lot of my time and effort in workforce development, in working with amazing tribal colleges and universities, working in indigenous research. And so, you know, I really believe, you know, especially with tribal colleges and universities, that they're just powerful hubs in our community for all sorts of amazing outcomes, research, education, you know, just cultural revitalization and empowerment. And so a lot of what I do is in collaboration with tribal colleges and universities. Even though I work at the University of Michigan. And the last aspect of the work that I do is directly with a lot of different types of science institutions, whether it's the work of supporting grassroots science, community-based science, including indigenous knowledge, but also dealing with some of these like large science institutions that, you know, for a long time didn't think that Native people knew that much. But then when they realized that we had a lot to contribute on topics like climate science and environmental science, they seek to change their institutions, but they've got a lot of lessons to learn. And so, I recently was a contributing author on the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change report that just came out, that's been making the rounds in the news, and have been actively engaged in trying to generate space for our own knowledge systems to take the lead in some of these critical reports and scientific institutions that are trying to help policymakers and the public understand the types of problems and the issues that we're facing. So I work in the context of, you know, tribal nations, and, you know, for me it's important that as Native people on any topic, but I've focused for a lot of my career on climate change, that we're empowered to take leadership in how to understand what climate change is, how to understand its impacts, how to take leadership in the solutions to climate change, and how to ultimately support our communities given the different issues that many Indigenous people and tribes are facing with respect to climate change. And in my work, I'm like surrounded by Native folks that are like taking direct action to deal with climate change, and they're not waiting for the United States to do so, and they're not, you know, waiting for state governments or corporations to do so. People are just doing the work. And so this is a image that the Bureau of Indian Affairs produced, and you can find on the Bureau of BIA's Tribal Resilience website, and it was part of the last National Climate Assessment in 2018 in the Tribes and Indigenous People chapter. But it documents all the different actions that Native people are taking to address climate change. And it gets updated. And given there's just, you know, several million Native folks, depending on how you count, there's over 1,000 actions that are documented, you know, current actions that Native people are doing. And for those of you experienced in Indian country, you know, if you can document 1,000 actions, that means there's like 3,000 or 4,000 that are actually happening. That's probably a conservative estimate. So just in terms of the stuff that tribes put out there that they're doing, there's at least 1,000. And this doesn't even count all of the actions that are taken to like stop pipelines and end extractive industries. So you add that, however many thousands of actions on top of this, and you're talking about many, many thousands of things that Native people are doing to address climate change, and they're just a few million of us. And you take a state like Michigan, for example, with 9 million people, and I guarantee you there are not thousands of citizen-led climate change actions taking place. And so this is the type of thing that we're doing, and the solutions are incredible, right? In cases where, for example, tribes are facing threats to important food like shellfish from warming trends and changes in water quality,
literally all of a sudden all of these different tribes start working together to figure out which places you can actually harvest from, which places are safe. They set up entire monitoring systems. It's like back in the day before colonization, when we worked together to solve problems and we weren't being blocked by all of these state and provincial and federal other types of borders. There are native communities that are looking directly at some of the habitats that are most challenged. Like, for example, in the Great Lakes, we have issues with wild rice, climate change, the warming, the changes in precipitation, especially the extreme like weather events, especially that involve flooding. All of that affects the habitat of wild rice, which is extremely important to Anishinaabe and other indigenous people in the Great Lakes region. But tribes aren't waiting around while that happens. They're looking at all the different ways through thinking about tree species and ways to improve the landscape to be able to make wild rice resilient to some of the climate change that is coming. On the other side of it, Native people are heavily involved, and there are other maps that demonstrate this as well, in mitigating climate change. You know, the United States pretty much cut us out of the energy system, and so we're starting now to realize, all right, how do we pick up the pieces and have our own energy system, and one that relies on renewable energy, and it doesn't actually play into some of the challenges of renewable energy systems in terms of technologies that rely on mining some other part of the world to get the supplies for it, and that usually affect indigenous communities or other people of color or low-income communities. And so a number of tribes are trying to figure out what does it mean to have our own community utility that's not just based on cutting costs, but based on supporting things that the community wants. For example, making elders' housing more affordable. And so across the board, Native people are doing very creative things to address climate change. And if we were in a slightly better situation with respect to the United States, then I think we would be doing even more and really emerging as leaders across the world as folks that are active in climate change. But the reason that we're experiencing the reason why we're taking all of these actions is because in every major scientific report or body of testimony from indigenous people, we are widely, depending on the community, experiencing some of the worst risks from climate change. The warming trends, the changes in precipitation, the increased incidence of extreme weather events, it's making it so that people are having threats to their health, to their culture, to their economies. And so across the board, and we've been documenting this for many decades now, we are facing some of the most challenging issues with respect to climate change. But this is just kind of a surface level understanding of what climate change is in relationship to Native people. And so oftentimes we talk about climate change in terms of a crisis, the crisis of climate change. But what does that crisis mean from the standpoint of diverse indigenous people? What is the affairs that exactly are in crisis? And so I think it's worth stepping back and actually thinking about what we're talking about in the first place when we say that climate change poses risks, whether to Native people or anybody else. And so I've been working through these different types of images to think about just the sheer different way that we think about a phenomena like climate change. So if the blue is several hundred years and the red is several thousand years, and we're thinking about how we imagine time and history. So in terms of the time that we're often taught in school, that is the time of like colonizer people, you know, oftentimes, right, and this explains why, and somebody earlier today was mentioning this, why you could grow up, say, in a place like Montana and Michigan and never know that there were tribes around you, because it's a short form of memory, right? It's a short form of memory where the main thing that you remember and are taught in history is when the United States started. So it's a form of memory where the stuff that resonates the most is like the last several hundred years, all the U.S. archives, the colonial archives. And then we're told that there is some stuff that happened before that, some strange connections to the Romans and the ancient Greeks and a period called the Dark Ages. But there's not a lot there. And I mean, I didn't even know about half of this until Netflix started making all of those series. But you're taught, right, that there, you know, the industrial era of the last couple of hundred years, I mean, this is kind of the main part of history. So anything before that, especially in a location like North America, well, what does that really mean? And so people that understand history in this way have more recently become concerned about climate change, because climate change has gotten to the point where the warming, the changes in precipitation, the increase in severity of extreme weather events, that is affecting their cost of living, that's affecting their well-being, their way of life, it's affecting the industrial way of life. And so they're concerned about how to deal with the fact that the way of life that's been developed for some people over the last couple hundred years is in peril. And so how to deal with that, right? Given that the various causes of climate change are also, for example, the dirty energy sector, are actually the causes of that industrial lifestyle and the energy and the different amenities that people take for granted as part of just how they expect to live today. And so climate change very much affects the time period that people are taking the most seriously, the one that they take the most for granted in terms of just the basic life conditions. And so that's one way of thinking about climate change in history. But I was thinking about Anishinaabe people, so Potawatomi, the tribe I'm part of, we're part of the larger Anishinaabe group, and we've got many great cousins on the Ojibwe side just here in Montana. And for us, right, the big deal is actually that there's thousands of years of history, right? Native people are not obsessed with the last couple hundred years. In fact, you know, we recognize that the last, you know, couple hundred years is just a small period of time in a much larger history that is ever present with us. And in fact, for Anishinaabe people and many others, we actually have stories from back in the day about climate change occurring. And even though like 1,000 years ago, we probably didn't cause it, in those stories, people still took responsibility for it. And so we have all these memories. We have memories of conflict and war and changes and transitions. And these little circles that were actually produced by the food stories from United Tribes Technical College, they map out, right, that we're also people that understood that our way of life was dependent on the seasons and shifting and moving and transforming society throughout the year to adapt to all the different seasonal change. And so we understood that across those several thousand years, we're constantly changing. In fact, it was motion that was normal, you know, and stability, which would have been the outlier. And so we knew that there were historic changes and that this is part of our history. And now we're in this little tiny period, which is actually the U.S. colonial period. And so for us, the big blue up top is the little blue down there. And, you know, this is the period where we've been, you know, subjugated and kind of forced into an industrial way of life. And nobody wants to live under colonization. We're not trying to take anything for granted in this small period that we're in at all. This is a period of being colonized. We're not trying to stay in this period. We're not even concerned that this period itself is in peril. We're trying to get out. We're trying to get out of this. And so climate change is a threat that's affecting us in a time period that we're trying to get out of. And some of my work, you know, I've emphasized that for a number of indigenous people, the way they tell it, we're already after a colonial apocalypse, and we're trying to move into something different and something new. We're trying to draw on the history and the heritage that we have that's been erased, the power of our knowledge and our wisdom to get into something better. And so for us, climate change is something that is most severe because we're already living under conditions of colonization. Tribes, for example, who are concerned that wild rice or another type of habitat is threatened by climate change, their ancestors wouldn't have been threatened by that because their ancestors had kinship relations across entire regions and they could handle different types of shortages and different types of threats because they were thinking about huge areas of land. But for a lot of us, we just have little tiny areas of land and only a few places to go harvesting, and we have to work to keep those a secret from other people. And because there's so few of those areas, climate change is a huge stressor. But we're not taking for granted that condition because we're thinking about the fact that the only reason why there's such a small area of land that's threatened by climate change is because of how our land bases were shrunk and dispossessed due to climate change. And so I think it's important to note, right, that for a lot of folks in the dominant society, climate change threatens this kind of whole aspect of what they take for granted. But for us, it's a threat that comes in a very particular time period that we're actually not trying to stay in, because nobody wants to stay, you know, in colonization. And for the way that Native people describe climate change, and this is from the recent Status of Tribes and Climate Change report that I'm very, very proud of. It's a report that brought together 90 authors and about 33, 34 indigenous testifiers to speak to all the different aspects of climate change. And I can't remember if I saw Marie Eggers or John Doyle here, but they were among the people that contributed some great testimonies about climate change issues that that they're dealing with and the work that they do. And so you notice here that this way of understanding climate change, it brings in all of these different aspects: drinking water infrastructure, emergency management, culture. It's about hope for future generations. It's about impacts of colonization. It's about guidance from ancestors. So this is a very different way of thinking about climate change than just focusing on the economic costs of changes in rainfall patterns. This is a way of thinking about climate change that is existential. And for indigenous people, right, climate change is both something, like I mentioned earlier, that people for many generations were quite familiar with, even if they hadn't experienced the dynamic between fossil fuels and increased concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. But they were very much about understanding the idea that a well-ordered society is one that's very, 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 very responsive to a constantly changing environment. And so when we experience climate change today, we're thinking about it across all of these different dimensions: health and well-being, water, air, biodiversity, thinking through tribal communities that are experiencing relocation, having to permanently change where they live due to things like coastal erosion that are associated with climate change. So we approach it from a very holistic standpoint. And one of the things that I want to convey very clearly is that when you look at some of these scientific assessments that talk about the significance of climate change for indigenous people, and I've been an author on each one of these, that they really are just conveying a very surface understanding of why indigenous people are threatened by climate change in the first place. And you'll see that typical categorization of this idea that indigenous people's health, their cultural integrity are affected by climate change, their economies are affected by climate change. But again, this is just the surface. For indigenous people, and I was recently part of a study that looked at this more closely, the first reason why we're vulnerable to climate change is because we were either relocated to a completely different location from our homelands, or our land base was shrunk to be exponentially smaller than our original homelands. In our study, and I'll show you the citation in a second, in our study we found that if you look at all of the land that indigenous people are currently on, that's a product of dispossession, you compared it to the historic homelands, the current land is more vulnerable to climate change. And so land dispossession is a fundamental factor of climate change, vulnerability for indigenous people. So it's not about being in the wrong place at the wrong time. It's rather part of this entire history that indigenous people have faced dealing with this problem of land dispossession, which means that solutions to climate change and ones that indigenous people are pursuing have to have a land back element, have to have a land sovereignty element, a land tenure element to it. Another aspect is self-determination. For many, many tribes, we have to actually govern communities on shoestring budgets. we don't have all the funds we need, all the staff we need to play all of the different government functions. We're not able to support our traditional persons and their endeavors to maintain our cultures and our social fabric. And we're in this situation where we literally ceded trillions of dollars of resources, assets, and territories to make way for the U.S. industrial economy, which played a big role in causing the climate change crisis. And in exchange for that, we're strapped with governments that do not have the resources, the capacities to play the types of roles that they need to play. And so we keep seeing absurd things happening out there in the relationship between the U.S. and tribes. For example, regarding energy issues, the U.S. established a huge multi-billion-dollar loan program, loan guarantee program for tribes on renewable energy. But why haven't any tribes use that program? Well, you have to shell out 200 or more K of your own cash to create the feasibility study, the energy feasibility study, to be able to access the loan guarantee. And as absurd as that sounds, this is the normal circumstance that many tribes are in. Every federal program that supports us is actually one that's very, very hard to access and that most tribes actually don't fully participate in anyways. And even if you do participate in it, oftentimes you have to do it in the way that the federal government wants and not the way that you want to do in terms of your community. And so we're facing this situation where our self-determination is very, very complicated, and we're not able to freely make decisions about how we spend resources and how we use funds. And again, we talk about this relationship with the federal government, but it's not a relationship that is the federal government giving us any gifts. It's actually a relationship that's some weird form of a bare minimum, given how much we ceded to make way for the United States, forcibly ceded. Another aspect is infrastructure. If you look at every major period of United States investment in infrastructure, tribes were left out of that, and the infrastructure that we do have is old, and it's aging. And so, for example, climate change resilience requires that you've got the drinking water infrastructure. It requires you have the transportation infrastructure, the air monitoring infrastructure, the electrical grid infrastructure for having your own energy system or your own utility. But most tribes either have none of this or they have old versions of it, but there's not enough funding and support to actually update all of the infrastructure. And so infrastructure is a huge issue because people sometimes think that if you just create a fund for tribal renewable energy, that that's all that you need. But you can't launch a legit renewable energy project unless you have all this other infrastructure in place, like being, you know, having infrastructure you need to have an electrical grid, transportation infrastructure, telecommunications infrastructure. And this is a massive coordination effort to be able to get tribes to that point where they can emerge as leaders in a new energy economy. And the fourth area, and perhaps one of the most important, is that climate change is still experienced with corporal and custodial violence. Colleagues at First Peoples Worldwide documented that when you're nearby a fossil fuel industry, there's human trafficking, there's all sorts of custodial violence. And the causes of climate change, the mining, the pipelines, and so on, are very visceral for many Native communities in places just like this. And so the experience of climate change is also an experience of violence, as well as just the violence that occurs when a colonial situation has made your very culture threatened by climate change. And so these are important sources that talk about some of the issues that I just described. And I think it's important to note then that the climate change crisis is a crisis of ongoing crises that still haven't been resolved. Crises of land dispossession, crises of infrastructure, crises of violence. These crises have been ongoing. They didn't start with climate change, but climate change did come about due to these forms of violence being imposed on us, these forms of colonialism being imposed on us, because that's how the fossil fuel industry got started in the first place. The fossil fuel industry would have never been able to have gotten off the ground in the way that it did in the 19th century and the early 20th century if it wasn't for the fact that there was rampant land dispossession and domination of indigenous people. And historically, it's important to really think about the fact that for a lot of us, it is kind of like a deja vu experience when we think about how other people talk about climate change today. So for example, with my tribe, this is some images from the 19th century that show a whole bunch of arrows and a whole bunch of shaded areas. So this is an image that shows how many times we were relocated and had our land base shrunk. So the green area is like Potawatomi homelands, and then we were in Iowa for a while. Then we were in Kansas for a while, but we were in two places. Then we got put in one place in Kansas. And that purple thing with the red square, that happened. We were all in the purple square, a bunch of Potawatomi people. And then the railroad wanted to come in as Kansas was becoming a state. And so then we got shrunk to the red area. And some of us made the choice to keep communal property, and some of us made the choice to take private property. But regardless of what choice you made, you either had your land base reduced, or the United States actually never delivered on the infrastructure, the agricultural training, and the other financial tools that they had promised. And so what you had happen at this time, it was a massive refugee crisis for Potawatomi people. It was a financial crisis because we owed taxes on lands when we weren't given the support we needed to start agricultural businesses that we were promised. And we were then dispossessed again of our own private property, or if we kept communal property, it was shrunk greatly. We experienced police and juridical violence at the time. We experienced hatred and discrimination. Our own citizenship was not respected by the state of Kansas, so we had no status in courts. And so literally it was a situation where the railroad, the different extractive industries that were coming in that part of the 19th century were threatening us. They wanted our land. We had imposed environmental change forced on us, right? As we got forced to move around, the habitats, the ecosystem changed. We were facing a struggle with infrastructure and finance and self-determination, and we were experiencing violence. And these are some sources that document some of that history. But if you think about like what I was just talking about, those different dimensions, like that's kind of just what climate change is right now. Because it's a form of imposed environmental change that other people, colonial capitalist, other powers impose on us. It's related to extractive industries and different types of transportation, other infrastructure. It's a crisis of self-determination, crisis of infrastructure, and crises of violence and insecurity. And so I think this is why it's important, especially for non-Native people, when they talk about how unprecedented climate change is. Well, who are you talking to? You know, who are you talking to when you say that? Because it's really not that unprecedented. Even if you just think about the specifics of it, yeah, there's different types of environmental change. But in terms of understanding the problems that create vulnerability to climate change in the first place, it hasn't. It really isn't that much different from what we've been going through for a long, long time. And every period of colonialism has involved the dominant society believing that it was threatened by something. Including the fact that they thought their own religion and spirituality was threatened by Native people's cultures and religions and beliefs. And so each period of colonialism has been a period where the dominant society felt it was in crisis, and they took action that worsened our situations and never addressed the root causes of the crises that we had been experiencing. Now, one of the biggest challenges right now is the more people get involved to try to solve climate change issues, especially solve them in a way that benefits indigenous people, we've noticed that there is another problem that people have very much been sleeping on and aren't aware of. And I highlighted this a little bit earlier, but if you think about this image from National Congress of American Indians, these are all different tribal institutions that you have in each tribe, different agencies, different programs. All of these are affected by climate change. And so one of the big questions is that if climate change is a function of land dispossession, And if our self-determination is needed to solve that, and we have these complicated governments, are the current solutions that are in place, including huge investments from the federal government, are they actually creating the land-based solutions that our communities need? Are they actually taking seriously the fact, and this is some images from our study, that climate change is really something that you can understand as tied to the legacies of land dispossession? And land dispossession is not just land loss, it's land loss plus a whole bunch of policies that make it very hard for you to govern the territory that you're in. And so tribal government to access resources has to go through a lot of red tape. And in Indian country, you find things that are very shocking. Like, for example, some tribes, for all of their hazard management, hazard mitigation, just have one staff person dealing with water issues, air issues, you know, extreme weather, like one person. Whereas like a state would have many different people focused on the different areas. And you could look at this across the board. I mean, a lot of tribes, for example, all of their air quality equipment is out of date. Where are the funds to fully update that? That's like air quality. And not even every tribe has an air quality program or has that type of technology to really monitor air quality. And so there's this issue that even if the federal government improves, even if the federal government were to make up for historical issues, that there has not been a solving of the problem of how funds at the federal government actually reach communities. Like, how do big federal investments, like in the Biden-Harris administration, billions of dollars for water sanitation, for climate resilience, to tribes, to over 570 tribes, how do those investments count on the ground? Well, one of the challenges is that actually people haven't been paying attention to the fact that that really has never been worked out. And the United States has actually reported on this, as ironic as that sounds, and across reports many, many years, the United States has admitted that it has not actually figured out how its own improvement in investments makes change on the ground for Native communities. So in the 2003 report, they had said, even when the U.S. increased its funding, there wasn't a noticeable change in improved tribal self-determination and Native people's well-being. So that we're actually in a situation where the capacity to make investments count on the ground is almost contradictory. You increase investment, it doesn't have the effect. And if you look down to the bigger bolded part, the U.S. even admitted that since that early 2000s report, that it backslid. It was worse. it was worse. And so we're not actually in a progressive situation. We're in a situation where to make investments count on the ground, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to make up for decades of marginalization. And so, for example, on renewable energy, a colleague, Catherine Sandoval, wrote some of the things for tribes that would need to take place to actually ensure a legitimate renewable energy program in the tribe. And look at all these issues, right? You need to deal with ensuring that tribes can own energy, their energy infrastructure. You need to make sure that tribal contractors and employers and entrepreneurs are part of the solution. You need to make sure there's energy efficiency and affordability, which requires a lot of revamping of housing and other types of infrastructure. You need to connect that to climate change threats within the tribe. That's a lot of stuff to work out. And this is just a very particular example tied to energy. And we look at it even more, it's really something that it just continues to surprise me how much a lot of people in the dominant society have been sleeping on this issue. And so if you think about our communities and the fabric of our communities, for generations, we've worked very, very hard to influence the settler resources. And so through our voting and awareness building, journalism, education, litigation, treaty rights, all of this, we've had to influence all of these powerful entities. And with some we've had a little bit of success with, like the federal government, to a degree with philanthropy, to a degree the national government, some international. But then there's others like the overall social hierarchy we've not had a lot of influence on. So we have persuaded, though, some of these groups that they need to increase the resources that are devoted to tribal communities. But if these triangles with the kind of the stitching in it refer to kind of the number of relationships, and so on our side or on the settler side, among ourselves, we have a lot of relationships with each other. We have a lot of friendships and professional relationships to make things happen. But as you get closer to the interface, the actual interface between, let me see, if you get to this interface point where power meets our communities, there aren't that many relationships. In fact, the institutions that sit in this area, the consultative processes, the liaisons, the local governments, the businesses, the tribal agencies, there's not a lot of resources invested in this interface. And so people that are working in this interface, many of whom are my heroes, because it's an area literally is right there at the crossroads of a transfer of resources and in a way that would make sense for tribal communities. But it's the area that there's almost been no investment in whatsoever. And it creates these contradictions. Like, for example, the White House rolled out more consultations than ever for tribes. Actually, tribes are overwhelmed by those consultations. So you can actually be consulted too much and you can be consulted too little. and that's because there's not a corresponding investment in tribal capacity to be consulted. All of the technical people needed to absorb agency consultations on energy, mining, all sorts of issues. And people that work in this middle ground have also tried to influence these different entities and to improve things. But again, it's not an area where people really focus on. But it's also an area that is very, very sensitive to issues of trust and reciprocity and consent. So we had some conversations earlier today about the fact that a lot of us don't have a lot of faith that the settler society is really going to make good on what it says it's going to do. Because the institutions that are needed to be able to make the change are not trustworthy. They don't have a track record of implementing change, and they typically don't do it in a way that's significant. We know that they're not trying to be reciprocal. We know that they're not taking our consent seriously, like in the example of consultation. They just think that more consultation will be what it takes. And so for us, this is a zone where what is needed is trust, a sense of reciprocity, that is, that resources will be mobilized in a way that treats us fairly in terms of what it is that we need to improve our well-being and our self-determination. There's not a lot of mutuality, right? And so this whole kind of area is one that is critical if there's ever going to be change. But most scientific studies don't even touch this area. Most scientists just focus on understanding trends in the federal government or international law issues. There isn't a lot of research, tribally led or otherwise, that actually addresses this area, this very local area. And there aren't very many career options where one could spend their whole career growing and building these institutions. In fact, many of us that started working at this interface, we've been pushed further out into national, state, international types of jobs and tasks. Yet culturally, for many tribes, you know, somebody's measure as an expert or a leader was whether they stayed grounded in their communities. And so this is a problem that literally makes it so that anything that anybody pledges to do, like for example, the Biden-Harris administration's pledge that 40% of the benefits of major climate investments will go to disadvantaged communities, including many tribal nations, And what we've seen in the policy work that I've been doing is that no matter how much we say that there are going to be billions of dollars invested, if we can't solve this issue, all of that money flows to outside contractors, states block the money from reaching disadvantaged communities, tribes who are eligible for the funding do not have the capacity to receive it and to take it in because of some of these bizarre things like the loan guarantee program I told you about. And this is so not on many people's radar, and it's going to continue to lead to this situation where history just repeats itself. And so it's going to threaten the energy transition, especially for tribes. It's going to create it so that if there is an energy transition, it's going to be one where privileged people enjoy the benefits of renewable energy, and other people do not have the same advantages, or still living in a common infrastructure situation, or still living in a not so great infrastructure situation, or still not actually controlling their own energy and are having to buy energy from others. It's also threatening our climate resilience because the infrastructural and the land-based issues that need support and improvement are not going to happen. And this is a crisis of human rights. It's a crisis of our freedom, our kinship, and our relationship to the land. And it's a crisis of relationships. It's a crisis of coordination. And I think when a lot of times we talk about justice, we don't really think about climate justice as largely a function of who has access to coordinated solutions. And the situation that I showed earlier is one where society is not actually set up to have the coordination that is needed to connect support for solutions to on-the-ground communities. But if you look at these different documents, I'd highly recommend everybody check out the things that that I'm recommending here. They're all things you can find online. But this report that I mentioned earlier that had 90 authors and I think 33 different testimonies goes into multiple examples of how Indigenous people are seeking to solve the coordination issue. Tribes are working together. For example, it has a whole example of an intertribal group working on just restoring a pollinator habitat. But the way they're doing it is bringing together multiple tribes. It's educative. It's bringing people back into being able to enjoy their culture and to practice their culture. It's improving relationships, not only among individuals and communities, but across tribal, state, local government. And so examples like that, which are throughout this report, are ones where you can see the goal of tribal climate change action is about coordination. It's not just about being concerned about the climate change impacts themselves, but actually realizing that the vulnerability to climate change is a function of this problem of coordination. And so we can understand injustice in a lot of different ways, but one type of injustice is a lack of access to coordinated solutions, or the coordination needed for a solution to really deliver and be and to matter. This is another source that has a lot of different essays on Indigenous culturally based direct action, power building solutions, again, to solve this issue of coordination. And this is a great report talking about how a lot of Indigenous direct action has stopped the fossil fuel industry. But part of the stories in this report is how it's been an intertribal effort. It's not just like one tribe or one organization, but Native people working together to pose a threat to the fossil fuel industry. And so programs like I've been part of and the tribal climate camp, which we were hosted once by the Salish Kootenai tribe, which was amazing. We work together as tribes, and the different folks that come to this come as teams from tribes to actually work together to try to figure out over the course of a week, how can we work strategically together to address climate change? And so I think in the Native context, when folks are talking about solutions to climate change, we're trying to restore and reinvigorate that coordination. We're not trying to ignore those institutions I was showing you in that complicated image, but trying to actually rebuild them. And if you look in all of the solutions the White House put out regarding tribes and Native people, you'll see that like at least half of the solutions are trying to get at these coordination issues. And I think that's an important way to actually read those reports. And so definitely if you have a phone to take a picture of this, because I wasn't planning on, you know, talking about each one, but literally if you look on the website, you just look at all of these different Native efforts to address climate change, they're all thinking about this in terms of relationships, coordinated relationships that have to be improved. So the last thing I'm just going to mention, because I know we had a bit of a, disruption which threw my timing off a little bit, which I'm not worried about. but what I just wanted to end with here is that, so if we agree that we are facing this issue, that even if the dominant society gets its act together and wants to really invest in tribal communities, that we don't actually know how those investments will be implemented on the ground. And this is really a problem of coordination. Well, the thing that kind of like just gets me is that when Native people talk about the importance of kinship, right? When Native people talk about the importance of kinship, like that is exactly what we are talking about. Kinship, when you think about kinship relationships, it's not just the relationships you have with your nuclear family. Your kinship relationships are relationships that are part of the fabric of your society, and they enable that society to be responsive to change. When you have a society that has a lot of kinship, it's kind of like when you get into a jam, who do you call to help you? Your kin. That could be your best friend, it could be a biological family, it could be a cousin. You call your kin because you know that when you're in a jam and you need immediate action taken, you need a solution right now, that there's some people that you can trust. There's some people that you know can act swiftly on your behalf and respect your consent, even if there's no time to sign a contract. There's some people that are so reciprocal that you know they'll always have your back because you'll have their back too. And that's actually what kinship is about. Kinship refers to the relationships of coordination. It's actually the science of what a coordinated society is that will be adaptive to all the different changes that are thrown at it. And so when I think about kinship, what a kinship relationship is, and this is just my theory and philosophy of it, but it's any relationship that when you practice it, when you take it super seriously, it's not just about that particular person or non-human, but when you take it seriously, you know that it's making the overall fabric of your society more capable of creating mutual support. So for example, if you're thinking about your family, if you have good family relationships, not all of us do, but if you don't have good family relationships, think about some good friends. when you invest in that relationship, it's because you know there's something much bigger that you're contributing to when you do that, right? That relationship with your friend is a support network, with your family is a support network. When you take their consent seriously, when you honor reciprocal exchange, when you do things that are trustworthy, you're creating that fabric. It's about the fabric, it's about the support fabric. And so the way I think about kinship, like in a case of responsibility, is it's, you know, you have responsibilities to each other, but what makes them really powerful is that they're layered with trust and consent and accountability and reciprocity. And so a lot of kinship traditions, and this is just the last thing that I'll show before I close, they're all about the fact that a society has to take very seriously its capacity to coordinate solutions. And so for Anishinaabe people, I've been trying to analyze it and think about how kinship worked. And kinship was about, again, creating that web of mutual support, investing in certain types of relationships to create that web of mutual support. And so if we begin with the idea that for Anishinaabe people, the whole world is one that's constantly changing and it's constantly, you know, doing all sorts of things, right? You know, every time a change occurs, like a seasonal change, society is mobilized. Like you're mobilized for a ceremony, you're mobilized for a harvesting or a family activity. And so, like, for example, in some of my work, when I've interviewed elders about climate change, they don't just talk about changes in insects or water, but they talk about changes in ceremonies, changes in the timing of key events and family life. You can't get somebody to just talk about physical climate change. It's always social, familial climate change. And so we tell time, right, through thinking about all the different social formations that are changing and shifting throughout the year. But what do all these social mobilizations do? Like a ceremony obviously is a good example. They build kinship, right? You go to ceremony each year. It's part of the reason why you show up and engage well in that, because it creates that trust, that consent. You know, it creates those key cultures that you need to have a society that you can rely on and other people in that society can rely on you. And so when you practice these different activities throughout the year, you're creating that cohesiveness so that all of your society functions like that person you call when you're in a jam. That you actually have a society that when you know things are hard, you have relationships of trust, reciprocity, consent in place to deliver the solutions. And so the kinship model creates preparation, knowledge, cohesion, and innovation. And Indigenous knowledge keepers, this is what they're specialists in. They're knowledge keepers of coordination. Indigenous knowledge is information about how a society can be well coordinated, how people can work together in a society, how a society can deliver solutions. So when you talk to elders and other knowledge keepers, they're giving you that science of kinship, that science of a social fabric, to the very detail. They're not talking about trends in federal spending. They're not talking about ideal laws and policies. They're talking about the kinship relationships that we need to know have to be in place if we're gonna be a society that's mutually supportive. And so I know there's 1,000 further connections I could make on this, but I just wanna leave you with this one point, that given all of these challenges we face with ensuring that solutions to climate change from powerful people reach Indigenous people, and we know that they're not yet capable of doing that, no matter how ambitious. It's just very, very ironic that we've actually been talking about this exact problem all the time, using language like kinship, and so many of other people have just thought that we were talking about romantic relationships with nature. And we were talking about nature, but it's much more complicated than that. I think it's time for Native people to really be respected in terms of the knowledge that we have and how practical and pragmatic it is to addressing the precise problems that foster inequality and climate injustice. Miigwech.
You've been listening to the 2022 Hauser Lecture at MSU, presented by Professor Kyle White and entitled Indigenous Climate Justice: Transforming Law, Energy, and Science, recorded on March 3rd, 2022 at the Museum of the Rockies.